Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jurevich. Declining birth rates means fewer high school graduates. And a decline in high school graduation rates means enrollment concerns for colleges and universities across the country. Couple that with increasing expenses and more people choosing the workforce over college debt, and that means trouble for colleges and universities, especially smaller to mid-sized campuses. According to Inside Higher Education, last year saw more college closures than the previous year. Ohio was not sheltered from this perfect storm of rising costs and enrollment challenges. This was the focus of an Ohio Newsroom report by our guest, Connor Morris, a reporter and producer for IdeaStream Public Media in Cleveland. Welcome to All Sides, Connor.
Hey, thank you for having me.
So earlier this year, you reported on the closure of Notre Dame College in South Euclid. Why did that school end up closing?
They had a lot of debt. And of course, as you mentioned at the top of the show, enrollment challenges as well. And in fact, we actually just did, it's very funny, I'm on the show right now. I just did a story yesterday about Ohio's AG filing a lawsuit against the former operators of the college, alleging they mismanaged money, used endowment funds to try to kind of paper over their issues with finances. They had about $16 million in debt, which might not seem like a lot to folks, but for a small college, that's quite a bit. And the operators said, you know, the board and the leaders at the time said, you know, we just can't really surmount this. We're going to have to close. And in the time since, it's been interesting because the campus has sat empty, of course. It's about 48 acres, pretty big amount of land there in South Euclid, which is like this, a suburb of Cleveland. And there have been some attempts, including women's soccer team, that league that they're trying to get started in Cleveland. They were considering buying the property, but nothing's really happened since. And that's been about a little more than a year now.
Yeah. So having something like that sit empty in South Euclid, I'm not super familiar with the area, but does it impact? Was Notre Dame College big enough to be a big employer for that area, too? So closing it had people lose their jobs and took, you know, kind of zapped a certain number of students out of the area quickly.
Yeah, it's a great question and a great point. The city has been working closely with the folks that remained to try to kind of wind down the college, essentially. Mm-hmm. And they've been really hoping to get a good kind of entity or entities in there to take over the space, because it's kind of right in the core of the city, and you know, beautiful green space that folks have traditionally historically been able to walk through. So there's a lot of vibrancy that is created by these, even if they're a smaller college. They had about 1,000 students. Mm-hmm. A lot of vibrancy that's created in cities. Those students are going to restaurants and shops, and all the folks that work there, still hundreds of employees, you know, to even run something of that nature, several hundred usually. And so that, you lose that tax base of those employees. Sometimes they stick around, sometimes they go elsewhere, though, unfortunately. And these are really linchpins of these small communities. You know, I'm an OU grad, and I lived down in Athens for a long while. And, you know, the community is really, it's quite a small, if people have been to Athens before, it's quite a small town. Mm-hmm. When school's not in session, you know?
Yeah.
So there's really a lot of vibrancy, a lot of money that comes into the local economy from these schools.
Now, you also wrote in your story about Notre Dame College that what happened to them served as a wake-up call for other schools of similar size. What do you think it helped other schools realize?
Yes. So the Ursuline College, not too far away, also in the suburbs of Cleveland, Pepper Pike, another religious school, they actually, Notre Dame closing, they saw that happening, and they decided that they were going to pursue a merger, which was with Gannon University over in Indiana, or I mean, excuse me, in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, other direction. Yeah. That state over there. Yeah.
That other state. Yeah. And that merger really kind of saved them in a sense. They were struggling as well with low enrollment, kind of just unique demographic issues as well. Midwest is considered kind of a tougher spot for enrollment, just because a lot of folks are kind of leaving, going to the West Coast or the East Coast. And same thing, as you mentioned at the top of the show as well, with the demographic issues, birth rates declining. And so this merger really helped them out a lot, because they've got kind of a little bit of a bigger financial backing now from this bigger institution. On the flip side of the coin, we did see University of Findlay, I believe, in Bluffton. They were looking at pursuing a merger recently, and that actually fell through. They were talking about it's a really complicated process for colleges to merge. You have to it takes years. I believe in Ursuline's case, it's not going to be done until like 2 or 3 years from now, and they approved it, yes, last year. So it takes a while and a lot of due diligence that's needed. And in the Findlay and Bluffton case, I believe that there were some issues with figuring out student financial aid and operating separate athletic programs that really ended up being a not a slam dunk for either of them. So they ended up dropping the proposal.
Yeah, I read that the University of Bluffton and University of Findlay merger was on, and now it's completely been called off because Findlay basically decided it was not in their best interest. And I did read that Bluffton is still looking for a new partner. So there's lots of nuance there. These mergers need to be good for both parties. Did you find in your reporting that it's the mergers are hard? It's not as easy as just saying, let's combine.
Yeah, there's a lot of like regulation you got to cut through. There's accreditation as well that needs to be navigated, which is really important for schools to keep that. So yeah, it could be kind of a mess. And also, you really need to think about, is this what's best for the university? You kind of there's a worry that you will lose your institution's individual identity, which is what I found at Ursuline. They were kind of worried about that initially, but after they did more of that kind of looking into it, they found that they were pretty aligned with the other institution that they ended up emerging with.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the challenges of rising costs and declining enrollments for smaller colleges with Connor Morris, a reporter and producer for IdeaStream Public Media in Cleveland. You also talked to the president of Lake Erie College, that's in Painesville. They were facing $5 million in debt. What did they do?
Yeah, that was as we mentioned earlier, it's been kind of this wake-up call with these enrollment issues and financial issues. Another thing that they kind of faced, and a lot of colleges have faced as well, is there was a lot of pandemic relief that was funneled into colleges and universities. And once that ended, they were using that to kind of paper over their issues. And once that ended, they were like, oh, wow, we really need to do some deeper thinking on what we do next here because this money's not here, anymore. So in their case, they looked at adding programming that was really desired in the community. So there was like an online degree for nursing, for example, and education-related degrees as well that they added. And so there are a lot of ways that colleges are looking now at their operations. You're seeing at other universities as well, they are cutting staff as well as low-enrolled programs. And with SB Senate Bill 1, the Higher Education Act that was passed recently, a lot of colleges and universities are actually required to do that now. They have to cut any low-enrolled programs. So there's this impetus there to really be as efficient as possible. We saw that at Baldwin-Wallace University as well. They've gone through, I think, two different rounds of cuts as well, which has meant programs being cut as well. We saw that at Cleveland State. And full disclosure, I do advise the student newspaper at Baldwin-Wallace. There's a really an impetus right now to be as efficient as possible, coming both from the state level and some pressure from the federal level as well. But also colleges have been wanting and universities have been wanting to do this as well because they want to be good stewards of taxpayer dollars, they typically say.
Something interesting that you reported that I found interesting was that the president of Lake Erie College said that they decided to treat their students more like customers, and that was a change for them, but it seems to be working. They were able to get out of the debt by treating their students like customers. Is that what you mean whenever you say that they because you would think you need to cut programs to save money, but they added a program.
Yeah, that's a great point. The investment is also key. Like a lot of colleges are trying to pivot as best as they can. What they also did at Lake Erie, which was kind of interesting, she said they're trying to bring fun back to campus as well, which I thought was kind of sweet. She was saying that they added back some summer programming and also some on campus like fun nights to hang out, like cookouts and things like that. So more things to make campus more vibrant. And she said that they got a lot of really good feedback from students who said, this is what I want. I want even though it's a smaller college, I want this more traditional college experience where you're going out and doing things, you're making friends, you know. And so that was another positive thing that that the president Jennifer Shuler kind of told me what, that they implemented that other colleges could maybe take some lessons from.
Another challenge for schools facing debt is how to deal with the debt. Wittenberg University has been placed in financial distressed status by the Higher Learning Commission, meaning it has more debt than income. Did you follow Wittenberg at all in your reporting?
No, unfortunately, I focusing mostly on Northeast Ohio, but I will say the lesson from Notre Dame is very similar there. You know, if you're running up debt, you know, year after year, and same thing with Baldwin Wallace as well. They had similar issues with kind of debt stacking up. It's only gonna it could ultimately torpedo your institution, basically. And so you really need to start looking at these things now, like, where can we shed costs? And unfortunately, that does mean laying off, you know, professors and staff sometimes. And so those are really difficult and unpopular decisions as well. I'm an education reporter, but I have kind of got have to become a finance reporter as well in this role. It's not just, you know, higher ed, you know, public schools as well have been facing this as well with rising costs and declining enrollment. You really need to figure out where are we best serving students and what can we cut.
Yeah, in the next segment, we're going to talk with the president of the Association of Independent Colleges and Universities in Ohio. But I guess in your experience on reporting on this, Ohio has a lot of small liberal arts schools. Do you think Ohio has too many colleges and universities? I don't know how you even measure that.
Yeah, you know, it's not really for me to
Yeah.
say, I think. And I really don't want, as a reporter, I really don't want to report on like colleges closing, right? Because these are like, as we mentioned, they're like the lifeblood of these small communities. You know, what I have reported on previously is there is a certain number of colleges, a relatively small number that close every year in the US. That number is expected through, there was an interesting study out of, I believe it was Philadelphia, the Federal Reserve Bank, that looked at AI kind of predictive model of how many more colleges are going to close. And they predicted that there's going to be a serious uptick because of this demographic cliff that we're kind of rapidly approaching here of declining birth rates and fewer students. And another thing that I just thought about in answer to one of your questions earlier as well about what else colleges could do, a lot of them are pivoting to try to recruit international students, and also they are trying to do more 2-year certificate programs, so more things that prepare folks for kind of the trades specifically. And you know, it's not just these smaller colleges and bigger colleges. You know, community colleges have also been seeing some struggles as well. Eastern Gateway Community College over in Steubenville actually closed last year as well, although they had a bit of a different circumstance.
I don't know their circumstance.
Oh no, sure. So they got in trouble with the feds for a they had a free tuition program that the federal government said they couldn't do anymore, essentially, and it was bringing in a lot of federal dollars to the school. Also, there was an investigation from, I believe, the state auditor's office. There was actually a bit of a, I'm not sure if you could call it a raid, but they showed up there probably about a year ago or so. And a couple of folks got in legal trouble as well who were involved with the college. So, kind of a, all of that led to kind of an unfortunate death spiral, and they ended up closing. Still trying to figure out what's going to be happening there. Youngstown State University, not too far away, just to the north there. They are had been talking about moving into the facilities that are left there in Steubenville, and I definitely have seen some reporting. The county commissioners there really want tenants to get to move into there. They really want that vibrancy to be back there that had been the result of the college, community college, being there for a while.
And you mentioned international students. The idea of recruiting international students makes sense financially because they typically pay a higher tuition because they're out of state, they're out of the country. They pay a higher tuition, they live on campus, that kind of thing. But the current political climate might make it harder to recruit those, for, the next few years.
And that's a very good point as well. We have been seeing student visas, another thing we've been reporting on lately across the state. Visas have been revoked for international students from, you know, Kent State to OSU, to University of Cincinnati, just all across the state, across the country as well. This is happening, and often there's just very little reason given for this. Sometimes attorneys for these students have said, "Oh, well, they had a speeding ticket," or "Oh, they actually did get arrested for something." Other times, there's really not any. The attorneys have said that they had a clean slate whatsoever. So that will make things challenging as well. You're absolutely right for these colleges to continue to find revenue to support their programming.
We've been speaking with Connor Morris, a reporter and producer for IdeaStream Public Media in Cleveland. Thank you for joining us on All Sides today, Connor.
Oh, happy to be here. Thank you.
And coming up, we're going to look at the challenges of declining enrollment and what it has on smaller colleges and their communities. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Planet Money helps you understand the economy. We find the people at the center of the story.
Garbage in New York, that was like a controlled substance.
We show you how money influences everything.
Tell me what you like by telling me how you spend your money.
And we dig until we get answers.
I had a bad feeling you're going to bring that up.
Planet Money finds out. All you have to do is listen. The Planet Money podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Many cities and towns across America were dependent on business or industry for their growth. Their populations and economic fortunes rose and fell with the growth or decline of those industries. A slide in birth rates is leading to a decline in high school graduation rates, which is causing enrollment concerns for America's college towns. The Wall Street Journal recently profiled Western Illinois University in Macomb, Illinois. The city is struggling as the university faces double-digit enrollment declines. And Macomb is not alone. Many cities have colleges and universities as a main economic driver. What happens when a once thriving college town goes from boom to bust as enrollment declines? Joining us as we continue our look at the challenges facing colleges and their communities is Todd Jones, President and General Counsel for the Association of Independent Colleges and Universities of Ohio. Welcome to All Sides, Todd.
Thank you.
And also taking part in our conversation is John Comerford, President of Otterbein University. Welcome to All Sides, John.
Thank you, Amy.
Now, John, let's begin with you, because the Wall Street Journal article that I just mentioned in the introduction has special significance for you, not just because you're an Illinois native. Can you tell us why?
Well, I'm a Western Illinois University alum, and I'm quite proud of it. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting to read about your alma mater on the front page of the Wall Street Journal.
Yes. So the Wall Street Journal profiled the university and the city. So the city's population, Macomb, has fallen 23% in the past 14 years. And campus enrollment at the university has fallen 47%. There's lots of factors in there, but as an alum of the university and now a president of a university, you're the president of Otterbein, how did you feel about reading about the challenges for a school in your, you know, your college town?
Well, as an alum, it wasn't news to me. I mean, we've all been watching the slow enrollment decline at Western and the effect it's had on Macomb for years. It's hard as an alum because this is a place that changed my life, that gave me my career. I loved Western. I love Western. I'm a proud Leatherneck, and I know there's some other ones out there listening. So it is hard to read about that, but it's also, as you said, reminiscent of the declining demographics in the Midwest, Illinois, Ohio, other places. And it's the schools often in the most rural locations that struggle first with enrollment. Getting an 18-year-old to come from Chicago to Macomb, a four-hour drive out to a, as we described at the time, out in the middle of the biggest cornfield on earth, can be hard work. And so it's those rural schools that often suffer first.
Yeah, and the Wall Street Journal profiled a few businesses in the area, you know, like a coffee shop that had been there forever that just doesn't have as much business. When you were there, I don't know what years you were at Western, but were there lots of little businesses? Was it a true college town?
Oh, well, Amy, you're going to go ahead and call out my age right away. I was there
I
in
didn't
the
do it.
mid-90s.
Yeah. Okay.
No, it's
Good.
okay. That's I can deal with it. It's not a big deal. I'm proud to have I've been class of 96 there
All
at
right.
Western. And in the 90s, we had about 13,000 students. My understanding is it's 5 or 6,000 now, and the town was about 20,000 people. It's about 15,000 now. And it was a classic college town. And given how remote it was, that was actually a benefit during my time, was you got into that community of students, and this whole town is built around the student experience. And there was lots to do and lots of ways to connect. And I had a great experience in my years in Macomb.
Todd Jones, president and general counsel for the Association of Independent Colleges and Universities of Ohio. I want to bring you into the conversation. What do you think when you hear about a city like Macomb being featured in the Wall Street Journal for struggling when the university is a major employer? So now both the university and the city, therefore, are struggling. What does that make you think from what you represent?
Well, I certainly think about it from a position of concern. I mean, in Ohio, we have a saying that if the college and the town have the same name, you're probably well tied to that institution, whether you're in Defiance or Bluffton or Hiram. And they all have small colleges, and they play a central role in the community. It's not just the economic vitality. I think about other aspects of the support that colleges bring to their community. So Defiance, for example, is assisting with special ed operations, both in that district and districts around it. In Bexley, Capital University is the pool that folks use in the local community. And all of those kind of integral parts of the existence of the town are also part of the integral operations of the university. You can't tease them apart.
Right, right. And John, how concerned are you as a talking with other college administrators about the decline in high school students that are choosing not to attend college? Are you seeing that? Do you feel like enrollment is trending down and there's fewer kids to recruit?
So as a sector, as an industry, that's certainly the case. It's especially the case with male students recently. We at Otterbein are up in female enrollment and down in male enrollment. I think that's pretty typical right now. But it's about the institution adjusting so that you can serve adult learners, which is one of the things we're doing at Otterbein through our partnership with Antioch University. And being more nimble about having programs that are high demand and finding ways to attract students. It is a demographic reality, though, that the Midwest, Northeast are all shrinking states. Mm-hmm. And while Columbus is growing, and Otterbein is lucky to be in a place like Columbus and Westerville, the demographics around us are just not moving in the right direction. The last thing this institution needs to do is be about access and affordability, open the door wider to higher education. So at Otterbein, if you're Pell Grant eligible and get the Ohio College Opportunity Grant, we cover your full tuition. Mm-hmm. It's a way to make sure that we're opening the door wider to higher ed, so we're not going to see the enrollment decline match the demographics, so we can get more young people to go to college.
And Todd, are you seeing what John just mentioned? There's fewer males going to college, maybe an increase in females, but overall enrollment is down.
Overall enrollment's down, males are down, low-income students are not rising back from the end of COVID as we saw with middle and upper-income students. Yes, it's the same. But also those strategies that John mentioned as well, looking at tailoring programs and graduate programs toward where there is demand. I mean, that is one of the advantages of small colleges. It's the ability to bring to bear a new program much more quickly than a larger institution would as it navigates its own internal bureaucracy.
Yeah. We talked in the first segment about Lake Erie College in Painesville, where they had significant amount of debt for the size of their school. But a way that they dealt with the debt was by adding a program. And you would think that they need to eliminate programs, which I'm sure they did some cuts, but they added a program because they saw a high demand for it and that helped them. Have you seen that?
That's right. And one of the realities is that students simply aren't engaging some disciplines as they did in the past. There are fewer students studying religion at most colleges. There are students who are not taking foreign language, but students want to take programs about AI. They want to look at data analytics. They want to look at equine. There are a lot of areas where there's an interest in students and growth, and if you're able to pivot and meet those demands as an institution, you're going to see the students retained to your university or coming there in the first place.
John, does Otterbein still have a significant equine program? I thought they
Oh, a national champion dressage
That's what
team.
I
Let's
thought.
not
That's what I
diminish how big this is. Yes.
thought. That's what I thought. Whenever you mentioned equine, I was like, wait, you're saying that as an Otterbein shout out there, aren't you?
Well, you know, we do have three of those here in the state of Ohio: Lake Erie, Otterbein, and Findlay.
Okay. No, I didn't know that. All right. Well, now I know. So, Todd, earlier we talked to a reporter about the closing of Notre Dame College in South Euclid. They were a part of your organization before they closed. What are your thoughts on that closing? I mean, did you help them to try to not close?
I was not there over the last year and a half, but I mean, I'd spoken to their board a number of times, and the difficulties they faced are ones that are not, they're not alone in facing. And it's not either a public or independent thing. There was an announcement just this week. They're going to close seven branch campuses of the Penn State University system. Which combined had 3,000 students. And I think that's the greatest difficulty here is for a smaller institution that makes a strategic wrong step can lead to their demise much easier than if you're a larger institution. So, for example, Urbana University closed 5 years ago. Part of what led to their demise was really some strategic decisions that were made about 10 years ago. And as they worked themselves out, there was just no coming back. Whereas we've seen Akron, the University of Akron, lose 50% of its enrollment over a decade plus, and we saw Wright State down over 40%. But they're large enough that they have the ability to redirect themselves, and as institutions, they're going to survive.
Yeah, John, whenever you heard about a college, Notre Dame College, closing, the reporter of that story said that it, for a lot of other schools, it was a wake-up call. Do you agree? Did you find, like, hearing about a school actually having to close, did that scare you as a university president?
Well, it's not news to me. I think it's often news to the alumni base and other folks that, oh, we didn't realize that these institutions that are often 150 years old or older could in fact close. And so that is news. And I often have to spend some time after something like that happens reassuring folks about Otterbein is in a different position, has a different program mix, has a different endowment, and is not at risk of closing because it is tough out there. And you do see public and private institutions struggling with those declines, whereas the institutions that, as I said, have been nimble and more responsive are more likely to be successful.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking with John Comerford, president of Otterbein University, and Todd Jones, president and general counsel for the Association of Independent Colleges and Universities of Ohio. Todd, let's just take a step back for a second. How many independent colleges and universities are in Ohio?
We have 50 members in our membership, and there are a small handful that are beyond that, a few seminaries, Cleveland Institute of Music. But really, if you're an independent college, you're probably a member of ours in Ohio. And we're the sixth largest association in the U.S., so there are five other states that have more colleges than we do, nonprofits.
Yeah, that was a question I posed to the reporter earlier in the show, was does Ohio have too many small colleges and universities? And I don't know how you know that exactly, but does Ohio have a lot? So you're saying we rank sixth, I guess?
Comparatively so. California, Illinois, Massachusetts, New York, Pennsylvania all have more than us. And really, it's...
And most of those states that you just listed have more population.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay.
And really, that is the reality, that in states like Florida, you have fewer, but it's also because Florida is a later growing state. We have so many colleges here because as this state became a state, people would come to an area, they would start a school, they'd build a church, and then they'd start a higher ed institution. That was a very typical pattern.
Now, John, what's the enrollment at Otterbein?
So we have about 2,500 students.
2,500. So that's what I was going to ask Todd. Like, what is considered small? Because, is it 1,000 students? Is it less than 5,000? When do you consider it small versus when does it become big?
Yeah, it's a relative term because I have two institutions that are roughly the size of Publix, the University of Dayton and Case Western Reserve. And even there, they would not be large Publix. They'd be smaller Publix. But among our members, we really don't think about an institution as small until it gets down to less than 1,000 students.
Okay. And you said you have about 50, is
that
right?
We have 50 institutions.
50 institutions in your organization. And in an organization like yours, are you advocating on behalf of those 50, at the state level? Like your organization exists to help kind of like unite them together, have them help each other?
Right. And we're able to talk to legislators about initiatives that and the impact they have. So, for example, my staff were meeting with our U.S. senators a couple of weeks ago to talk to them about here's the impact of proposals in the budget bill, budget reconciliation, and what that would mean for this college or that college. Here's what's important about parent loans, about graduate loans, and we make the case there. We do a number of other services of group purchase and so on for our members as well.
And what would you say there's the advantage of being smaller and independent over a competitor like Ohio State? Whenever you talk to the small colleges, what do they have that you know an Ohio State doesn't?
Really, the simplest piece is personalization. And I know that sounds kind of abstract, but to give you a reality, I remember Gordon Gee one time says, we're going to double the number of counselors for students from 160 to 80. So one for every 80 students as opposed to one for every 160 would be an academic advisor. At our colleges, we call academic advisors professors. Mm. I mean, that's the kind of personalization you're able to get. And that's why, again, it depends upon who's being served in our institutions, but our institutions do a little better on retention. They have better graduation rates against peer public institutions, and it really turns on that personalization, that you have a human contact who is interested and invested in your success.
And John, turning to you about Otterbein, how does a school the size of Otterbein compete with the Ohio State Universities and the Ohio Universities of the state?
Well, it is the case that we now compete primarily with the larger public institutions. We don't really compete with other smaller privates or mid-sized privates. And so what's the advantage of our position versus a big public? We think it's experiential learning. And so we've said things like you can go to the big school and watch, you can come here and do. And so you can play Division III athletics, you can play on the esports team, you can be in the marching band, you can be on the equine team. You can have these experiences without, you know, having to go through the very selective process. You're gonna, when you have 60,000 students, only so many can be on the band or be on the basketball team. And the reality is we can give some more of those experiences and pair the great liberal arts academic experience along with the co-curricular experience that I don't think the big schools can match.
Mm-hmm. Todd, do you see in your 50 members that you have of your organization, do most of them have sports teams? Is that because sports is expensive?
Well, we have three art colleges and six nursing colleges who don't have athletics. But yes, of the remainder, there's a surprising diversity of sports out there. I mean, we have a competitive pit crew team and at the University of Northwestern Ohio who do racing. And so, yeah, there are a lot of opportunities out there from ultimate frisbee to, well, very successful Division III football at Mount Union, I think about.
Now, and whenever you call yourself the Association of Independent Colleges and Universities, can you what makes it independent? It's just not public.
That's right. Well, it's not for profit. We are all nonprofit institutions.
Okay. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about the challenges of rising costs and declining enrollments for smaller colleges with Todd Jones, the president and general counsel of the Association of Independent Colleges and Universities of Ohio, and John Comerford, president of Otterbein University. After the break, we will talk about more challenges of declining enrollment and the challenge it has in the community surrounding the college. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Planet Money helps you understand the economy. We find the people at the center of the story.
Garbage in New York, that was like a controlled substance.
We show you how money influences everything.
Tell me what you like by telling me how you spend your money.
And we dig until we get answers.
I had a bad feeling you're going to bring that up.
Planet Money finds out. All you have to do is listen. The Planet Money podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Since March of 2020, at least 79 public or private nonprofit colleges have closed or merged with other universities. Some of these changes in schools' fortunes are due to the declining of high school graduation rates, which eventually leads to declining college enrollment. In addition, recent headlines have questioned the value of a college education as trade careers are beginning to seem more lucrative. More students are forgoing college debt and instead choosing to go right into the workforce after high school. We're talking about the effect declining enrollment at colleges can have on schools and the towns they serve. Still with us is Todd Jones, President and General Counsel of the Association of Independent Colleges and Universities of Ohio. Thanks again for being here, Todd.
Thank you.
And John Comerford, President of Otterbein University. Thanks again for being here, John.
Thank you.
I wanted to talk about mergers and partnerships. So, John, let's start with you. You mentioned your partnership with Antioch. So we're not going to use the word merger there. But tell me about the idea of a partnership, having a partnership with other universities and colleges. Why work together, I guess?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. And we have the idea that rather than compete with one another for enrollments, we should collaborate. And so Antioch University is an adult learning organization with campuses in Seattle, Los Angeles, Santa Barbara, New England, about 4,000 adult learners. And they're great at adult learning in a way that a traditional college like Otterbein never really could scale. And we're set up for 18 to 22-year-olds. And so we are leveraging Otterbein's graduate programs through Antioch at all those other sites and then sharing in the benefits. We're also collaborating on some shared services, getting some efficiency in the back-end processes, and actually creating accelerated pathways to graduate school. So an Otterbein undergraduate can get up to 9 graduate credits while they're still an undergraduate towards an Antioch degree and shave off a whole semester of graduate school. And so all that is sort of a finding a win-win out of a win-lose competitive scenario. And we're working actually to build this into a national network of schools called the Coalition for the Common Good, hopefully with dozens of independent colleges collaborating and sharing adult programs through Antioch eventually.
And Todd Jones, tell me about the idea of mergers. It is a way to help a couple of smaller colleges share resources, eliminate duplication, that kind of thing. But there more recently, just in the news, there was the merger of the University of Findlay and the University of Bluffton were trying to merge, and that merger fell through. So from your view, how do you feel? Do mergers work?
Mergers can work, and I think we look at what's happening at Ursuline, for example, which you can describe as a merger, you can describe as an acquisition. They'll be a piece of this other institution, but you have to find a way that works for both institutions, and so it's going to be more the exception than the rule. Mm-hmm. But I wouldn't think of that as a problem in that there's a whole range of collaborative structures that can lead to success for multiple institutions. It could be everything from joint degree programs or allowing transfer across institutions for students who are going there, but your degree is from one of the two or three that's part of the group. It could be simply acquisition of programs where a college is purchased by another institution and whole programs retain their identity, retain their location, and move to a new institution. But it's going to be difficult no matter how this structure operates when you're looking at an institution that's needing to subsume its identity either into a new collaboration or into another institution itself because it's no longer financially viable.
Now, Ursuline is an example of a merger that's going through, and I mean, we won't know it's successful until it actually happens and we see what happens a few years down the road. Have there been mergers in the past, 10 to 20 years that have worked in Ohio?
Yeah, there have actually been two I could point to. One was MedCentral College of Nursing, which was in Mansfield, and they realized they didn't have the capital to make the investments they needed to keep the nursing program going. So they merged with Ashland University, and it continues to this day as the Dwight Schar College of Nursing. Similarly, the largest independent podiatric medicine college in America was located in Independence, Ohio, and they merged with Kent State University, which is unusual, a nonprofit into a for-profit. Mm-hmm. They wanted to expand their research work, and they needed a partner who did not have a medical program. So you would look in the greater Cleveland area. Obviously, they're not going to merge with Case because Case has a medical partnership already with its university hospital. So they looked around at another partner to accentuate their research work, and they merged into Kent State, and they continue to operate there today.
Are you familiar with the University of Findlay and Bluffton situation? Findlay decided that it wasn't in their best interest to complete that merger.
That's correct. And I've spoken with the president and the president of Findlay and the former president of Bluffton, and it's one of those that as you go through a negotiation process, some deals do not work out, and unfortunately, that was one of them.
Are you is your organization the type that can help Bluffton find another partner?
It's funny you say that. I had a conversation with a number of my peers about 5 years ago about whether there's a role for our institutions in doing that. And really, aside from the expertise side of it, it's also there are different interests for each institution in a merger process. And candidly, we have to treat each member equally. And when you move through a merger process, it's not always a merger of equals.
Mm. Earlier we were talking about the cities and towns across the country whose populations and fortunes are tied to a particular industry. So the location of colleges and universities is often linked to schools. John, tell me about your relationship with Westerville, because Otterbein, I don't know exactly how many employees Otterbein brings to the Westerville area, but how does Otterbein and Westerville work together?
So we're lucky to be in a first-ring suburb of Columbus, you know, this fast-growing metropolitan community. And there was a time 30, 40 years ago when you could have called Westerville a college town. Otterbein would have been one of the dominant employers. At this point, we're fortunate to be one of many big employers in the city, and the city's really done a nice job of diversifying its employment base. That's, frankly, in large part thanks to location. I was president of Blackburn College in Illinois in a small town, Carlinville, Illinois, another rural community where it had a much harder time diversifying. And so it's been really essential for the university and for the city to diversify the employment base of the community that it's in.
Mm. Todd, what is your feeling on, you know, the way a city and the university work together or need each other? I think Bluffton might be a good example. You know, they're looking to merge, so obviously they're having some financial problems. But would Bluffton be in trouble if the university went away?
The city would certainly have some financial difficulties if Bluffton University were not there, because mm-hmm. it is such a dominant piece of that community. And like I said, you can point to a number of communities where that is the case in Ohio. I mean, not that there's any threat to Oberlin College, but mm-hmm. Oberlin College is a dominant piece of the Oberlin community. And mm-hmm. you look at how the students make sure that the restaurants are operating, but also the service time that they provide. And there's more loss than just money when you're without a college in your small town.
And John, with Otterbein, is partnering with Antioch. Antioch has been through a different number of iterations of its existence over time. And it's also a big part of the Yellow Springs area. That town and Antioch are kind of, you know, one and the same. What is your organization? Is Antioch a unique example, I guess, is what I'm trying to say, of like going through different periods of growth and decline and growth and decline, and you know they're coming out the other side?
Yeah, so Antioch University and Antioch College split about 15 years ago. So the college in Yellow Springs now operates independently from the university, which is the adult provider that we've coordinated with. But it is a great example of I think Yellow Springs owes its existence to Antioch College and its unique vibe to being a college town. And it really needs Antioch College to be successful there in Yellow Springs. And we're all rooting for that to happen. Mm. But it is hard to attract students to these rural communities sometimes. And so I know they're being creative and being nimble as they do that. And it's part of what we're thinking about, too, is how do we diversify our enrollment stream? And that's part of let's get graduate students in Seattle and L.A. and take a national footprint in the adult market as opposed to being limited, even though we're in a great spot in Westerville and Columbus. How do we diversify that even further?
And let's talk for a minute about enrollment and recruitment. John, at Otterbein, where do you recruit most of your students from? Are they Ohioans, or are you recruiting from outside of the state?
So we're 80% Ohioans, mm-hmm. and we're about a third of the student body is Pell Grant eligible, so low to moderate income. And so access and affordability is key to what we are and how we do it. You mentioned, Amy, before athletics are expensive, and they can be. But in Division III athletics, we find athletics are enrollment driver. That a lot of students want to go to college and need to play their favorite sport. And so Division III, we don't do athletic scholarships. It's college sports as it was meant to be, pure mm-hmm. amateurism. And so we find that a lot of students come to study their chosen major, but also to keep playing lacrosse or soccer or football or whatever it is. And that's an important part of their experience.
Todd, what do you see from your organization? Is it mostly Ohioans going to these Ohio small colleges? Do you have any numbers of how many come from outside of the state to go to your 50 organizations?
Interesting question. In fact, I don't have the latest data on the tip of my tongue, but I can tell you that Ohio, both public and independent colleges, we're the third largest state in attracting people from outside the state to come here, behind mm-hmm. Arizona and Pennsylvania. And it's important because Ohio has demographic challenges. I mean, it's the mm-hmm. same challenge that's causing our problem, but we're shedding people in this state. And really, our population's been flat for about 60 years. We have only so many ways to attract Ohioans. And I say that as somebody who moved here in their 30s. I'd mm-hmm. Barely been to the state. It's a wonderful place. But we also know that not a lot of people are moving here. And one of the ways we can get them to come is to come through higher ed and choose to stay and see opportunity here. And I think it's an important way for our state to focus its policy on how do we bring students here and make them welcome.
I can say the only reason I am in Ohio is because my husband went to Otterbein. So he, and then he got a job after Otterbein in Ohio. And then here we are. So let's talk a little bit about international students. There's a move to, earlier in the show, we talked about the idea of recruiting more international students because their tuition is higher. They're paying not just out of state tuition, but then there's the room and board. But then there's also this issue of the current political climate and maybe not being able to recruit as many international students. John, do international students play a role in recruitment at Otterbein?
They certainly do. We've never had a large contingent of international students. And I know that the schools that have large contingents, 10-20% of the enrollment may be international students, are nervous right now. During the first Trump administration, international enrollments declined significantly nationally. And Secretary Rubio just the other day ordered a stop to embassies processing student visas temporarily so they could review more of the social media and activism of the potential incoming international students. And so I think that will cause more international students to look at Europe and Australia and other places that can offer Western degree experiences, and that will hurt those schools. And so we do have partnerships in China and Vietnam and get some enrollment there, but we're not as reliant as some other schools are.
Todd, do you know of the number of in your organization, if they recruit international students, or is it vary a lot college to college?
It does vary college to college, and there are a large number. Our nursing colleges, for example, don't recruit international mm-hmm. students, but many are like Otterbein, that they have a handful coming in. It helps in the interest of the campus itself. It creates a more interesting cultural environment for people to join, but the institutions in our state, for the most part, are not as heavily drawing international students. We have a few elite liberal arts colleges that do. Case Western Reserve brings in international students. Ohio State is obviously one mm-hmm. of the very biggest international recruitment institutions in our state.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking with Todd Jones, President and General Counsel of the Association of Independent Colleges and Universities, and John Comerford, President of Otterbein University. We only have a few minutes left, John, but I wanted to just come back to where we all started, which was thinking about your alma mater, Western Illinois University, and what's happening there in Macomb. And, there's a lot of small colleges and universities here in Ohio. Does thinking about what's happening to the town where you went to college, does it worry you a little bit as a president of university? Do you think that maybe we're going to see a few more colleges and universities here in Ohio struggle over the next few years?
I don't doubt, Amy, there will be more consolidation. The reality is our higher education system, public and private, was built for the baby boom generation. We built up to after World War II for the GI Bill, and then their kids come in the 70s, 60s and 70s. And then we've seen a demographic decline since then. And so we do have too many schools with too many seats. And so schools either need to get creative, open the door through access and affordability initiatives, or merge, consolidate, and cooperate to be more competitive in that environment. And we're seeing it at privates and at especially the regional publics, places like Western Illinois. The flagships usually do just fine. It's the regional publics that tend to suffer. And so this does worry me, and it means we have to be more innovative than we've been as a sector in the past.
Todd, you were nodding your head. You agree?
He's absolutely right. I mean, the difficulties that we're going to have, there are going to be some colleges that are no longer in existence, both public and independent. But I also, when people ask, well, is it this one or is it that one? I think about half dozen years ago, if you had asked me if Wilberforce can survive, I'd look at it and I'd say, I'm not sure. Today, I would say they're thriving and, and growing rapidly. And the question is why? And I think it's a combination of leadership of the institution, both board and president. It's a focus on students that gives them an experience that they're attracted to. And then, of course, the larger financial picture as to how much debt do they come in? How much, how are their facilities for the future?
Well, I want to thank you both for your time today. We've been talking with Todd Jones, president and general counsel of the Association of Independent Colleges and Universities of Ohio. Todd, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
And also John Comerford, president of Otterbein University. Thank you for your time today, John.
Thanks, Amy.
And this is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jarovich. Thanks for listening.